Oregon is one of the few places in the world where the flag has two distinct sides. The front is the seal of the state of Oregon. The backside is a beaver. Just a beaver. No words. Oregon is the beaver state, after all. Sorry, Oregon Ducks fans. And it is beavers we will talk about in this hour as we get a sense of just how much beavers were responsible for the landscapes that existed in our part of the world for centuries. It's a very different landscape without the beavers. Our guest explains all this in his new book. Ben Goldfarb is the author of Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Ben Goldfarb covers conservation, biology, and wildlife management. In his work as an environmental journalist, he brings his own expertise to the work with a master's degree in environmental management from Yale. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben Goldfarb.
Thanks, and we're praying for rain here in Spokane, too.
Oh, good. Okay, we'll all work on this together. First couple of pages, you see a beaver in person and you catch your breath. What was it that caused that inhale?
Yeah, you know, I think that we don't appreciate how big beavers are. You know, I think that generally when you see a beaver, you know, you see a head poking above the water off in the distance, and you kind of get the impression that beavers are, you know, maybe a little bit larger than house cats. But these are quite hefty animals. As anybody who's ever trapped one knows, you know, beavers, I mean, a full-grown beaver can be 60, 70 pounds. So these are pretty substantial critters.
And I'm struck again by how this is one of those mammals that looks very, very uncomfortable walking on land.
Yeah, exactly. Beavers are of course semi-aquatic, so they spend most of their time in the water. And you're right that on land they're, you know, sort of these fat, slow, smelly meat packages, as one scientist described them to me. But in water, you know, they have these incredibly powerful webbed hind feet they use for swimming. They have a second set of transparent eyelids they can use as goggles. They're really incredibly well adapted for their aquatic element.
We'll fill in details as we go along through the hour, but just as an overview, how profound an effect on watercourses and the surrounding landscapes did beavers once have?
Yeah, it's in some ways it's hard to know because, you know, by the time naturalists and ecologists, you know, really took detailed notes about what our landscapes looked like, you know, beavers had been trapped out for the fur trade. But you know, there's no question that North America was once a much lusher, wetter, more ponded and wetland-covered place. You know, you read these historic descriptions of early trappers and explorers, you know, crossing places that today we consider, you know, basically desert, like eastern Oregon, eastern Wyoming, you know, and finding these incredible complexes of ponds and wetlands. So there's no question that beavers once impounded huge amounts of water all over North America. And, again, it was certainly a lusher continent.
So without the dams and the ponds behind them, we lost habitat, it seems like, for bunches of other creatures as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's in the West, you know, wetlands are just 2% of total land area, but they support 80% of biodiversity. So the loss of all those beaver-created wetlands would have been a huge catastrophe for all kinds of creatures. You know, waterfowl are very dependent on beavers, of course. Amphibians, frogs and salamanders, cutthroat trout. And I think the biggest, you know, the biggest connection of all is really salmon. You know, we know that these beaver ponds are fantastic slow water refuges where baby salmon can grow up. There's no question that the loss of all of those beaver created refuges would have been catastrophic for salmon populations.
I found myself thinking about that this morning, about the whole idea of the resting ponds that we keep getting reminded by the fish biologists that beavers need and the salmon need. And it seems like with beavers creating dams and ponds all over the place, there would have been lots of chances to rest.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're a little finger length juvenile salmon, you know, you don't want to be in the main channel. You'll just get blown downstream. You know, you want a nice slow, deep pool where you can, you know, hide from herons and kingfishers and, you know, conserve some energy. So absolutely, the beavers, these beaver ponds and all of the beaver side channels, you know, that were created. I mean, when beavers raise water levels, you know, they force water onto the floodplain and they fill up lots of these slow water side channels. You know, they take these kind of single thread streams and turn them into really complex multi-threaded streams and that's great for salmon as well. So no question, beavers create fantastic juvenile salmon habitat.
Well, and the opening vignette in the book is with a guy who's trying to bring back trumpeter swans by helping put beaver back in the landscape in the Rockies. Now, this is where we expect narrow, swift-flowing streams. Is that expectation not in line with what the history was?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it depends on where you are. Certainly, you know, there would have been high gradient streams, you know, really steep streams that weren't appropriate for beavers, where their dams would just blow out. But I think it'll, you know, a lot of these sort of broader, flatter river valleys, you know, they would just would have been full of beavers. And the guy that you mentioned is a biologist named Drew Reed, who's doing this this beaver restoration work in the Gros Ventre Valley, which is, you know, sort of around Jackson Hole. And it's just this, you know, this broad kind of meadow filled, you know, sort of hole basically between mountain ranges. And that would have just been beaver central once upon a time. And, you know, the loss of beavers when they were extracted for the fur trade led to this catastrophic decline of trumpeter swans, among other species. And, you know, the reason for that is first that swans use beaver ponds as foraging areas. You know, they eat the aquatic plants that grow in beaver ponds, but they also nest directly atop beaver lodges. You know, these beaver lodges, those sort of, you know, island-like structures that beavers create, are really perfect nesting platforms where, you know, swans can lay eggs and raise their chicks safe from predators. So those beaver lodges would have been fantastic sort of waterfowl nesting platforms as well.
So when we lost the beavers, we lost a lot of other things as well. This is explained in great detail in Ben Goldfarb's book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. We'll get further into all the things that beavers are capable of doing when let loose upon the landscape. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Ben Goldfarb and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the science journalist Ben Goldfarb. He's written a story called, it's a very big book and a very interesting book about beavers and all the things they do across the landscape. It's called Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, talk about beaver stories, and I don't mean Oregon State beavers, but, you know, the idea of the actual animal on the landscape. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come to a real basic question. Why do beavers build dams? What are they doing from their own perspective when they do these things that block up water courses and create ponds and wetlands?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, beavers are really agile, powerful swimmers. They're great underwater, and on land, you know, they're not so great. They're a bit, as anybody's ever seen a beaver hauled out on a stream bank knows, they're a bit clumsy, and they're, you know, the result, they're eaten by all kinds of large carnivores, you know, wolves, bears, cougars, coyotes, even lynx will take down a young beaver. So, you know, they're certainly pretty vulnerable on land. And in water, they're much safer. So that's kind of the primary function of the dam, is basically expanding, deepening, widening the extent of this watery habitat where they're less vulnerable to predators.
I'm still struck by the fact that some of the places you've described already are places that don't see a lot of rainfall. But it sounds like if you had beavers, you had marshes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, a single beaver colony can, you know, create as many as 10 or 15 dams. So they're storing quite a bit of water, and you know, really, just again turning these somewhat arid landscapes into these lush wetland complexes.
Which is okay. So it's certainly a different look to the landscape and different habitat. And you already mentioned that wetlands are like 2% of the American West, but 80% of the biodiversity. But you mentioned effects even below the Earth's surface, which is probably one of the most fascinating parts of the book. What goes on under those beaver ponds?
Right. It's a good question. So when you look at a beaver pond, of course, there's the surface water, right? There's all of the visible water you see in the pond. But then the weight of all of that water is also sort of forcing more water still into the ground. It's you know, infiltrating through the soil. It's raising water tables. It's recharging aquifers. And you know, there have been studies done out in eastern Washington where I live, showing that you know as much as 5 to 10 times more water is stored below ground in a beaver pond than above it. So you know the water storage benefits in the water table, in the groundwater, can be truly immense. You know, and I think that there's still lots of research ongoing about exactly how much water beavers are storing below ground, and you know how much of that water is actually making its way to downstream users, you know, farms and ranches, for productive use. So you know, we're still trying to figure out exactly how big a contribution beavers make for water storage and water conservation. But we know they're storing truly prodigious amounts of water in their ponds and in groundwater.
You mentioned that it was a long time before the naturalists came on the scene and actually started recording what the landscape looks like. So, I mean, did anybody think when they were going, oh, wow, that would make a great hat, that they should look a little bit more at the beaver and what the habitat was like?
Yeah, you know, I think it's when you read Lewis and Clark's journals, you know, Meriwether Lewis, he was a really great beaver observer, actually. He is especially, you know, as they're going up the Missouri and in Montana, you know, he had some really wonderful observations about just how incredibly profound beaver influence was on the land. You know, they talked about seeing beaver dams in every single tributary of the Missouri as far as the eye could see up to the base of the mountain. You know, I mean, it's in many places they actually couldn't. Lewis and Clark could not navigate the valley bottoms because beavers had so thoroughly dammed and ponded, you know, these tributaries. They actually had to walk along the ridge lines or stay in the main stem Missouri because some of these tributaries were completely filled with beaver infrastructure. So, you know, Lewis and Clark got it to an extent, but not many others did.
So, I mean, was there a certain level of resentment over beavers for just that sort of thing? I mean, they cut down our trees and they block up our streams and all that stuff. I mean, it sounds like there's a fair amount of grudge against beavers still.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, and look, I mean, I'm a self-described beaver believer. You know, like many beaver conservationists tend to be, but you know, I'm not naive about how challenging they can be to live with. You know, as you say, they cut down people's trees, you know, they flood property. And the biggest conflict in many places is just conflicts with roads. You know, beavers love damming in road culverts, which sort of makes sense, right? I mean, if you're a beaver, you know, the entire road bed is sort of the basis of your dam. And then the culvert is the leak in the dam, right? So if you plug up that culvert, you know, you can create this truly spectacular intact dam. You know, so you definitely see lots of beavers damming in culverts, and you know that is certainly a frequent source of conflict.
Ben Goldfarb is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Beavers, you say, are ecological and hydrological Swiss Army knives. That's high praise. In what sense?
Well, by that I mean that they are capable of helping us address so many different environmental problems. You know, we've talked about the incredible habitat they provide, especially for salmon. You know, in southern Oregon, I mean, you've got all of these listed, you know, coho and steelhead runs, and beavers can certainly help with that. You know, we know that they're these great water storage tools that can, to some extent, help us adapt to drought. You know, we know that their wetlands can serve as really useful fire breaks, which is, you know, certainly a topic of conversation right now. You know, they actually improve water quality, right? These wetlands are filtering out pollutants and improving water quality. You know, in some places, they're actually slowing down floods. You know, we think about beavers as causing floods, but their ponds actually sort of absorb and spread out and disperse and slow down, you know, stormwater pulses. You know, you get a big, you know, a big surge of rainwater coming through a system, and a beaver pond complex can actually slow that down for you. You know, so there are all of these different problems that beavers and their ponds and wetlands are helping us address. So that's sort of where the Swiss Army knife metaphor came from.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the one of the first vignettes in the book where you're with Drew Reed, who was trying to restore trumpeter swans in Wyoming and in the process restore beavers to the landscape because they nest upon the beaver dams. The trumpeter swans do, but there's another vignette here that seems very far removed from nature. This is a great description you give of this dreary morning in 2015 at a conference in a Seattle hotel. What was going on there?
Yeah, you know, I think that was where my conversion to beaver believer began. At the time I was living in Seattle. I was working for the magazine High Country News, which covers environmental issues throughout the American West. And, you know, I'd always been, you know, something of a casual beaver fan. So I caught wind of a beaver workshop or a conference or something like that. And I was definitely intrigued. So I went to this beaver conference that was being put on by a bunch of, you know, sort of public land agencies and native tribes and conservation groups. And, you know, in there, I just came to realize, listening to all of these really, you know, well-learned, charismatic speakers, that, you know, my perception of beavers as this, you know, sort of neat landscape feature, but, you know, nothing really more. I kind of realized that I was just vastly underrating this animal, you know, and that beavers played such a vast, influential role in American history, ecology, hydrology, even geology, you know, changing the very landforms themselves. So it was really, you know, here it was going to that conference and hearing all of those really inspiring speakers and then spending time in the field with them subsequently that turned me into a beaver believer.
So do the beaver believers agree on an approach though, Ben? I mean, do they all sort of feel the same way about what should happen from here to restore beavers to the landscape?
You know, I think that there is general broad agreement among the you know, the beaver conservationists. I mean, like any sort of subfield, you know, you'll have some minor disputes. But I think that in general, beaver believers, yeah, they believe that, you know, that coexisting with this animal can help us tackle all kinds of ecological problems. You know, and I think that's the biggest thing is coexistence, right? I mean, I mentioned all of the challenges that come with living alongside beavers and all of the ways in which they can be sometimes a pain in the butt. And, you know, I think that beaver believers recognize that there are ways of solving those problems in many cases that don't involve trapping out the offending animal every time it cuts down a cottonwood or clogs up a road culvert. You know, there are non-lethal strategies that in many cases are actually more cost-effective and are certainly more ecologically sound than sort of reflexively resorting to trapping every time there's a problem.
We'll get into the discussion about some of the items that have been introduced that help beavers and humans live together. Ben Goldfarb is our guest. His book is called Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Share stories about beavers in your past, your concerns about beavers, or your celebration of beavers if you're a beaver believer. And again, I don't mean Oregon State University. Join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is William in Sutherland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. William, go ahead. Okay, William is listening on his radio, which is 10 seconds behind the rest of the world because of our delay system. We did have an earlier call from John and Vanita who didn't stay on the line. He said beavers can be very dangerous. I mean, can they be dangerous to people or dangerous through the things they do to human structures?
I've certainly heard concerns about beavers as a dangerous animal. You know, there's sort of this one semi-famous incident that happened in Europe actually a few years ago when a fisherman tried to take a picture with a beaver and a beaver bit him in the leg and severed an artery and he actually died. So that's the only known beaver caused human fatality. But you know, look, it's like any wild animal. If you give them a wide berth, stay out of their way, respect their boundaries, you know, they'll leave you alone. Beavers are, you know, as most people who've ever encountered a beaver know, beavers are generally pretty shy and retiring, and they're, you know, far, far, far more afraid of you than you are of them. So just stay out of their way. a good rule of thumb for interacting with all wild animals.
That is actually a good idea for all wildlife. Nora in Eugene sent in an email that hits the nail right on the head. She says, our beaver is in decline like everyone else. Thanks, Nora in Eugene.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the general trajectory of beavers in North America is really positive. You know, and I mean, at the end of the kind of the industrial scale fur trade in 1900 or so, there were about 100,000 beavers left in North America. You know, down from hundreds of millions at the time of European arrival. You know, these days there are maybe 15 million beavers or so in North America. So, you know, they've certainly rebounded incredibly well from, you know, from the destruction of the industrial fur trade. So, you know, from that perspective, beavers are doing pretty well. But, you know, they're still at a very small fraction of historic population levels. So, you know, there's still lots and lots and lots of room to return these animals further still to our lands and waters.
All right, but not a sensitive or protected species?
No, yeah, not a protected species. They're actually, you know, in Oregon, they're considered a predator. So, you know, you can basically, you know, landowners can basically take them out. So they're not considered protected, no.
All right, let's try William and Sutherland one more time. Are you there? Nope, I can hear us 10 seconds behind the rest of the world. So here's Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. So we live in Eugene, two buildings from the Willamette River. And across the river from us is Delta Ponds, which is a huge asset to the community. And about 20 years ago, my partner Bill and I were over there, and because we enjoyed taking walks there. And all of a sudden, we saw about 20 feet away from us this baby beaver that was about the size of a half-grown cat. And so we just stood still and watched it, and it started coming toward us. And it walked right in front of our feet, and it went over to a blackberry bush. It was this time of the year, the blackberries were ripe, and was trying to reach the blackberries. So I went over to it. It didn't run away. I got blackberries and held them by their stems so that the little beaver could get a hold of them. And so I stood there for about 15 minutes feeding blackberries to this beaver. It got purple mouth, purple paws, and finally I couldn't resist. I stroked the inner fur of its little ears, and it was the softest thing I've ever felt. That's my beaver story.
Wow, that's quite a beaver story. Thanks for that, Anne. Appreciate it. Not a recommended course of action, though, I understand, from what you just said, Ben Goldfield.
No, yeah, I would not advise that for most people. But yeah, that does sound like an incredibly special, powerful experience. And, you know, it's true that certainly beavers can acclimate to humans to some extent. You know, when I used to live in the state of Massachusetts, and there we had a beaver pond that had been continuously occupied by beavers for many decades. And, you know, people would actually climb on top of the lodge to fish. They would fish off the lodge for bass. You know, the beavers would still come out and work on their lodge even as people were fishing off of it. Huh. I guess those beavers had become very well acclimated to human presence. So, yeah, they can certainly adapt to people. You know, they can be pretty urban critters if you let them.
And we have an email from Becca in Lane County who jumps on the bandwagon, too, about beavers can be dangerous if you pick one up and try to snuggle with it like I want to do. So another urging not to get too close to beavers. So Anne was the lucky one. She got to stroke the beaver's ears, and the rest of us will have to admire from a distance. So the fur, though, that Anne talked about, this is really the key to beaver decimation, isn't it? I mean, it's just some wonderful construction on the body of a beaver.
Right. So beavers have incredibly dense fur, which, you know, which makes sense. I mean, you're an animal that spends all of its time, or much of its time in the water. You have to stay warm somehow. And beavers actually have as many individual hairs on a patch of skin the size of a postage stamp as we humans have on our entire heads. So really remarkably dense fur. And they actually have two layers of fur. They have the kind of the coarser, longer, outer guard hairs, And they have kind of a layer of under fur or beaver wool, it's often called. And that's actually the material that gets felted into hats. And those little under hairs have little barbs on them, and they kind of interlock together almost like Velcro. And that's what makes it such a, you know, a durable, malleable, waterproof material as that beaver under fur.
But this is what really was the key to their decimation, wasn't it? I mean, that they were just people adored that fur and would take it for hats and so many other things too, and ended up killing so many of the beavers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the first wave of European fur trappers and traders arrived in the early 1600s, and you know, basically spread west across the continent. And I mean, that was really, you know, along with timber and cod, you know, beavers were really the most important natural resource in the New World. You know, and I mean, it was really beavers, the relentless drive for beaver pelts, you know, helped motivate the Revolutionary War insofar as, you know, the British denied colonists access to trapping grounds, and that was one of the things that really angered the colonists. You know, beavers were in part behind the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, that was really Jefferson trying to secure more trapping ground for the fur trade.
Okay, much more to talk about beavers with Ben Goldfarb in 1 minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are getting a real education in the value of beavers, not just to the beaver state of Oregon, but to many other parts of the American West where water is not plentiful, and yet beavers, with all their dams and ponds, did create a lot of wetlands over the years. And without beavers, the landscape has changed greatly. All this is covered in Ben Goldfarb's book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So finish the thought. You were saying the Louisiana Purchase had a lot to do with beavers?
Right, exactly. That was you know, in part Jefferson trying to secure new trapping grounds for the continuation of the fur trade. And, you know, and then, of course, I mean, the history of Oregon is intimately bound up with beavers. You know, there's a reason that beavers are on the flag. You know, obviously the town of Astoria was originally a fur trading outpost. And, you know, beavers in 1849, you know, the Oregon Territory minted its own coins and put beavers on the coins. And a single beaver coin was worth one beaver pelt. So just as people advocate going to the gold standard today, you know, the Oregon Territory actually had the pelt standard. That's how integral beavers were to the territory's early economy.
Wow. So the beavers really are well entrenched or a big part of Oregon lore and history. Let's we finally have William and Sutherland on the line. Welcome to that. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ben Goldfarb.
Yeah. How are you guys today?
Doing okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I've had a lot of experience with beavers. When I was a boy in central Wisconsin, we had an 80-acre farm, and well, I spent all my time in the woods when I was old, from 6 to 12 years old. And we had a beaver pond on the back of our property. And I spent a lot of time back there with the beavers. And one of the byproducts of the beaver ponds was that there were these side channels that they had created over years from dragging these limbs and logs down to their lodge. They take that stuff and actually submerge it in the water, and then in the wintertime when the pond freezes over, they have a food supply because they feed on that cambium layer on that wood.
Right.
One of the byproducts was I'd go down there and catch snapping turtles, take them home, and my dad would clean them, and we'd eat them.
Huh.
I ate a lot of turtle.
I bet you did. That's a great story. And of course, there is a whole community called Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, probably not far from where you grew up. But this is a fairly typical story, it sounds like, in a place where beavers frequented.
Yeah, you know, I think the great point that William makes is that we think about beavers as these dam and lodge constructors, but they're also amazing diggers. You know, they create these really elaborate sort of canal networks that they use to access food sites. You know, so instead of having to walk overland and expose themselves to predators, you know, they can just dig a canal and swim right up to that tasty looking aspen and drag that down the canal back to their pond. So, you know, those canals they kind of get short shrift, I think, sometimes when we think about all the things that beavers are capable of doing, but they're actually really important, not only for the beavers themselves, but those canals are great great sites for turtles and frogs and fish and all kinds of critters. So that was a great call by William.
Do the beavers have a preference for certain kinds of trees? I mean, my guess would be that they'd want the ones that are a little easier to chew down.
Yeah, exactly. You know, in the West, you know, the kind of the three classic beaver trees are willow, aspen, and cottonwood, and those are the ones that they tend to go for. Those seem to be the tastiest, and you know, they're relatively soft, as you say, and easy to gnaw down. But you know, beavers will take down just about any deciduous tree. They tend to avoid conifers. They'll eat. You know, their scientists call them choosy generalists. So they have their favorites, but they'll eat most things. They eat lots of green vegetation too. They don't just eat trees. They also eat cattails and water lilies and all kinds of aquatic plants as well.
Okay, so this is probably the time to talk about beaver digestion, because they are well efficient. Let's put it that way. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, exactly. So beavers. Beavers eat their own poop. There's no way to sort of sugarcoat that. They basically, and that makes sense. I mean, they're eating this very specialized diet. They eat the cambium, as William said, which is the inner bark of trees. That's kind of the layer of bark that does the growing. And they're actually digesting cellulose, which is a trick that we humans haven't really figured out. So to accomplish that, they're kind of the first round of excrement is sort of this thick black pudding-like substance, and then they actually re-ingest that and sort of ferment it in their hind gut. When it comes out again, it's basically like sawdust, because they've extracted, you know, every dollop of nutrients from their food. So beavers are nothing if not efficient, for sure.
Wow, nothing wasted by beavers. Although, we have an email here from Ariel, no town given, who writes, "We used to have beavers on our creek and enjoyed watching them, even though they did take down trees. However, we haven't seen any for a long time. A few months ago, a fairly large cedar tree next to the creek was chewed down by a beaver, but there's been no other sign of them. Why would a rogue beaver chew down a tree and then disappear?" That from Ariel, no town given.
Yeah, it's a great question, and there are probably maybe there are people out there listening right now who have a good answer for her. Off the top of my head, I'm really not sure. Cedar is certainly not one of their preferred food trees, although I have definitely heard of them taking them down. I think that ultimately beaver behavior is kind of mysterious. I've been out to beaver ponds with very experienced beaver scientists who kind of scratch their heads sometimes and say, "Huh, I wonder why they did what they did there." So if somebody has a good explanation for why a beaver would take down a cedar and then split town, send it in, because I'm curious too.
Okay. I want to come back to a point you made, though, about the Louisiana Purchase, because it's broader than that. You write that beavers help explain just about every significant American geopolitical event up to the Civil War. Really?
Yeah, I think it sounds like a bit of a grandiose statement, but I think it's supported by most historical evidence. I mean, take New England. When the first Puritans arrived, the Plymouth Colony and the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Those colonists owed lots of money to their creditors back in England, who had bankrolled these voyages. And the only way they could pay those debts off was by trading for pelts with Native Americans and shipping those pelts back across the Atlantic. So it was really, it was really beavers that in some ways made the Plymouth Colony, the Massachusetts Bay Colony possible. So when you start digging into, just how profound a role this animal played in westward expansion and colonization, it's really, really remarkable. And of course it was also, it also spelled disaster for many Native American populations too. I mean, it was those fur traders and trappers, those white fur traders and trappers, who introduced smallpox and other diseases to, many of the tribes they encountered.
So, oh, sure, they would have been the first people
to
have contact.
Beavers are sort of the story of American history and all of its grandeur and tragedy.
What was the Native American approach toward beavers? Did they live with them, or did they also take apart their dams and kill beavers? They ate some of them.
Yeah, it's a, It's a good question. I think that different tribes had really different approaches to beavers depending on local ecology and hydrology. You know, so in places, you know, back in the Northeast where forests are thick and water is really abundant, those tribes, like the Cree, definitely ate beavers and participated in the fur trade with white traders. But as the fur trade shifted westward into these more arid landscapes, in places like the Dakotas and Montana and Wyoming, a lot of those plains tribes actually did not eat beavers and considered beavers sacred. And the reason for that, is that you're in this very dry sort of intermountain western landscape where, any entity capable of creating watering holes for game becomes incredibly important. So, so those tribes, like the Blackfeet, recognized the centrality of beavers to these dry western ecosystems and didn't eat them, didn't hunt them and trade their pelts with white people. Considered beavers sacred and revered them.
So Ben, who were the first people who said, the landscape is different in the West without beavers? These arid landscapes have gone back to being arid landscapes because we've taken the beavers and the beaver dams and the marshes out. Who first said, that this place would be different if we still had beavers here?
Yeah, I think by the end of the 19th century, we had slowly begun to recognize the importance of this animal. We had trapped out, not only beavers, but also bison, of course, and the passenger pigeon had gone nearly extinct at that time. And we were sort of beginning to recognize that the natural world is somewhat finite and we're capable of eradicating entire species. I think that by around the turn of the century, we had sort of begun to recognize that, hey, these are really important animals and far from eliminating them, we actually want to begin to restore them to Western landscapes. There's this one naturalist named Enos Mills who wrote this kind of famous beaver book in 1913 that really that called the beaver the original conservationist and advocated for its return. So, by the early 1900s, there was sort of this counter movement of beaver relocation and restoration in the American West.
And you went far and wide in search of people working with beavers and dealing with beavers and to see the beavers themselves. And one of those places actually was right in our listening area in the Scott Valley of Northern California. What was the beaver situation there?
Yeah, that's a really cool beaver story. So the story there is, as any Scott Valley resident will know, is that the Scott Valley was actually once the Beaver Valley. That was the name the trappers originally gave it. In the year 1850 alone, 1,800 beavers were extracted from the Scott Valley. And, by the late 19th century, beavers had been essentially wiped out from the area. And, and gold dredge mining came in and kind of destroyed a lot of that really good salmon habitat in the Scott. And, in the last several years, there has been this effort to restore beavers to this kind of degraded landscape as a way of creating salmon habitat. So the way that groups like the Scott Valley Watershed Council have gone about it is by installing these structures called beaver dam analogs, which are basically human-built beaver dams. The idea is that you pound a few posts into the stream bed, weave a few willows, and you basically give beavers kind of a starter kit, a little leg up, which will induce them to colonize an area that they wouldn't necessarily want to colonize otherwise. You have these streams that have been really degraded by mining. Not a great place for a beaver to live, but if you build one of these starter kits, then you can kind of encourage beavers to show up and stick around and create some of this great slow water salmon refuge habitat that's so important, especially for coho salmon in the Scott Valley. So that's kind of a cool example of recruiting beavers to use them as a fish restoration tool.
And we mentioned earlier that there are efforts to make sure that when beavers do move back into habitats, that they don't do things like wreck roads and railroads and things like that. So what kinds of structures and gadgets have people developed to help the beavers do what the beavers do and yet still be able to make sure that they don't end up flooding areas that people need dry?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the kind of the the crucial structure in beaver coexistence is this contraption called a flow device. And a flow device is basically a pipe and fence system that you can pass the pipe through a freestanding beaver dam or through a road culvert and basically pass water through the pipe and regulate the height of the pond. So you can say, okay, you know, like, hey, I like having beavers here. I appreciate all this great salmon habitat they're creating, but you know, I don't want the road to be washed out or my field to be underwater. So I'll install one of these devices and basically strike a kind of a compromise between human and rodent. There's enough water for the beavers to remain, but not so much that it's a problem for infrastructure. So, you know, in Oregon, there's a guy named Jacob Shockey, who's a company called Beaver State Wildlife Solutions, I believe, who does flow device installation. And in California, there's a guy named Kevin Swift. And if you're having beaver problems, I encourage you to call one of those two guys, Jacob Shockey or Kevin Swift, because they can help you out.
So, Ben, just a few seconds left. You urge in the book that we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back too heartily. Is there still a lot of ground to travel in beaver comeback?
Yeah, definitely. Again, you know, there are many streams that beavers have returned to, like gangbusters, but there are still plenty of places, including Northern California especially, that there's still a long way to go in bringing these animals back to our landscapes, and they can do a whole lot of good if we let them.
Well, there's a part in here that we didn't get to, beavers versus Walmart, and for a little while the beavers won, but that'll have to go for another day. Ben Goldfarb has been our guest. His book is called Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.